Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests today. First, in moments, Anatole Levin will talk about Hillary the Hawk. And at the bottom of the hour, sociologist Alex Vitale will talk about Ferguson and the larger context of policing. First, Anatole Levin. Levin, who teaches at Georgetown's Foreign Service School in Qatar, is author of a piece in the December 15th edition of The Nation, A Hawk Named Hillary, on the presumptive Democratic nominee's foreign policy. There were some technical glitches with this interview, thanks to our friends at Time Warner, who provide my telephone service. After four some minutes, I found the dropouts insufferable and switched to my cell phone, whose signal turned out to be better than I'd feared, but not perfect. Apologies for the suboptimality. Here's Anatole Levin. I'm impressed that you seem to have gotten all the way through Hard Choices, which is something I couldn't do. How could you describe the experience?
Well, not a very cheerful one, I have to say. I kept thinking, my God, you know, is this the best alternative to the Republicans that the American political system can come up with? Because on domestic policy, perhaps she will surprise us. But on foreign policy, it just became more and more apparent. Not just that she hasn't learned anything from past mistakes, including her own, but that she's incapable of learning anything and is completely unwilling to learn. And I don't think that it's just a matter of defending her record. I think that she is so completely by now a product of what is in effect, under the shouting, a bipartisan establishment, that she isn't actually capable of learning from the experiences of the past.
Reading a 600-page book that was written with the assistance of, I believe, three ghostwriters, she shows no signs of actually thinking about anything, reflecting about anything. Her just seems to string together cliches and bromides and banalities. There's not much thought that goes on there.
Well, no. It is, of course, in effect, an election manifesto. To a degree, what do you expect? But then again, given that U.S. politics is in such trouble in different parts of the world, and given that the challenges and dangers are so great, I do think that both the international community and the American people did have a right to expect more thought. And the really annoying thing is that at one stage she does sort of half apologize for her vote in favor of the Iraq war and has this line about, the need to learn from our mistakes, but she doesn't say what we're to learn. And then, of course, when it comes to Libya, it's almost incredible that in this book she's still presenting, the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime as a success, even as, Libya by now has been in a state of civil war for over a year. And, of course, instability and Islamist radicalism has been spread all over not just North but Central Africa. And the book is littered with this really odious, infuriating phrase that we must move on. There's some brief acknowledgement that, perhaps mistakes were made, but we must move on. What that means, of course, is that the rest of the world has automatically to go on following America, whatever America does. And, whatever has gone wrong in the past, people have no right whatsoever to draw any conclusions from that. Well, of course, that just drives people all over the world crazy with fury when they hear that.
Well, this is the country that brought you History is Bunk, so I guess Move On sort of fits in with that.
Well, it does, but it's part, you see, of what I'm increasingly beginning to find a quite terrifying syndrome. And by the way, I should say this is completely true in Europe as well as in the United States, which is that intimately tied up with the inability to learn from the past is the inability to take responsibility for anything anymore. nobody ever seems to take responsibility for anything anymore or to be held to account to responsibility. I mean, the team, you know, that took America into the disaster of Iraq, that in the process, you know, caused a second disaster in Afghanistan through a mixture of brutality and negligence. The British team under Tony Blair, you know, which associated Britain with these catastrophes, nobody has paid any price whatsoever. It's really extraordinary. And then if you look at the parties concerned, you know, they too have learned nothing except a sort of basic caution, of course, when it comes to direct military interventions, you know.
At this point where I switched from the dodgy Time Warner connection to my iPhone, my question in the first moments of Lieben's answer got lost. I'd said that by some accounts, Obama boxed in Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State since he ran foreign policy out of the White House, allowing her a little leeway. Lieben began by saying it's not clear how differently she would have operated on her own, but that it might have been a good thing had they followed her advice in Afghanistan. And then he continues.
On other issues, however, I'm not sure that that is much of an excuse. After all, you know, when it came to the pivot against China, or the pivot to Asia, as it's euphemistically called, Clinton, as she makes clear, and as her article in 2011 made clear, was completely behind that. And when it comes to policy towards Russia, Victoria Nuland, you know, who really helped to drive an aggressively anti-Russian policy in Ukraine, was, of course, a Clinton appointee, or Clinton promoted her within the State Department. And there's certainly no evidence of any difference between Clinton and Obama on that. So that I don't think that, except possibly to some degree on Afghanistan, that Clinton can use Obama as an excuse in this regard.
That Russia policy, she seems to be pretty hawkish, and you know, for all the faults of Putin's Russia, this is a very unproductive stance with a very large and tough and important country.
Well, the thing is, look, it might make sense if the U.S. was in a position to really invest full commitment in this policy, including putting the enormous sums of money into Ukraine that would be necessary both to reform its economy and to orient its economy away from Russia. And that would require, of course, full commitment on the part of the United States and also prioritizing Ukraine and an anti-Russian policy above all other issues, including the Middle East and China. But as we know very well, in fact, Ukraine and Russia are not that important to the United States. And the United States cannot, in fact, do that because it has so much greater needs and greater commitments elsewhere. So the U.S. is essentially telling the Europeans that it's their business to do this, while, of course, as always, at the same time, egging the Europeans on, or some of the Europeans, to take the most hawkish stance that they possibly can. Well, this seems to me deeply irresponsible, and it reflects something which is very much true of the U.S. establishment in general, but it's also true, I think, of Clinton personally, which is a complete inability to prioritize, to look at things coldly and say, look, this is the most important interest of the United States in the world. Other things have to take second place, and therefore on other things we have to compromise. Because otherwise, of course, you end up with what you in fact have, which is severe problems of overextension at a time of enormous budgetary constraint, which is exactly where Clinton, you know, has helped to take the United States. The other thing which is so striking from Clinton's book, and once again, this is not just true of her, it's true of the U.S. media and the establishment in general, is that she continues to repeat the lie that it was Russia that attacked Georgia in 2008 and not the other way around. Now, whatever the background rights and wrongs of the issue in South Ossetia, it was the Georgian troops who moved into the place and attacked the Russian peacekeepers there in August 2008, and Russia which retaliated against that. Well, the inability to recognize that, and you know, it may be that she's been genuinely you know, misinformed and isn't just, you know, lying or lying to herself. But the inability to recognize this means that she and the establishment have not analyzed the dangers involved in trying to build up local allies in this way against Russia, or indeed against anyone else, without in the end being prepared to fight for them. Now, that is bad in the former Soviet Union. In East Asia, it risks complete catastrophe, because there you have a situation in which a China, which is much more powerful than Russia, and is getting more powerful all the time, has actual territorial disputes with neighbors, which are either are allies of the United States, or which, like Japan, or which the United States, very much, you know, with Clinton behind this, is trying to turn into allies. And that raises the question, you know, how far is the United States prepared to go? If it is prepared to fight, should it be risking war over these islands? If it isn't prepared to fight, should it be egging the Indians, the Vietnamese, and others on into what may become a war, which the US will then have to run away from, as it did in Georgia and as it's doing in Ukraine? And none of this has been thought through. Now, I'm not saying that Clinton in this regard is any, you know, is worse than anybody else, but she's certainly no better. And I think from that point of view, there is simply no reason to place any confidence in a future Clinton presidency in the foreign policy field.
She wrote the piece for Foreign Affairs before she became Secretary of State, announcing a pivot towards Asia. What precisely did she mean by that?
I think it was foreign policy, was it not? But anyway, that's not important. I mean, it was quite clear from reading it that pivot to Asia meant the containment of China. She hardly troubled really to disguise that, though it wasn't said explicitly. I mean, the point is to build up a ring of pro-American states around China that will prevent the further expansion of China's power and the extension of China's military positions. Now, it is necessary to say, by the way, that you know, China has done itself no favors by taking this very aggressive stance, not just over one island group towards, you know, which is disputed with Japan, but basically, you know, on all the island groups. But by that, it has in fact worried its entire region and you know, really driven a number of other countries into the arms of the United States. But at the same time, there is, you know, Clinton in the pivot to Asia, and in what she's written about, it has shown no willingness at all to consider whether there a more nuanced policy is possible. For example, whether the United States could have proposed a compromise on joint sovereignty of these island groups. Now, it's quite likely that that would have been rejected by everybody, but at least it would have put the United States in a more neutral position, and in a position where it would still be able to negotiate with China. At the moment, it can't. Similarly with the other island groups. Also, the United States needs to distinguish between cases where China is clearly acting illegitimately under international law, especially when it comes to the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea, and other cases where, as in the Senkaku Islands disputed with Japan, China may actually have a historical right on its side. It does look as if Clinton is just incapable of understanding relations with China in anything other than a basically Cold War way, you know, that essentially one is moving towards a sort of an Asian NATO to encircle China. But the problem is, as I say, that the Soviet Union, despite its military strength, was in other respects always a very weak state. China is not a weak state. It will soon be the biggest economy in the world. And approaching China in this, you know, absolutely unnuanced way, in the security field, does risk disaster, because, of course, the U.S. is encouraging other countries in the region, notably Vietnam, China, but also an increasingly nationalist and even aggressive India under Narendra Modi, which also, of course, has a territorial dispute with China, and encouraging them to take tougher and tougher lines. Well, the risk here, of course, as we saw, you know, with Georgia in August 2008, is that some local client state will, you know, through independent action towards China, get into a conflict, which will then face the United States with a very, very dangerous and unwelcome choice between either going to war or backing away and leaving its prestige and credibility in shreds.
Well, it seems like more than two decades after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States still can't shake off these instincts of the Cold War, like rollback, containment. All these reflexes seem fairly intact. They're just looking to apply them to a different set of circumstances, but with the same instincts.
Well, I'm afraid that is true, and I think it reflects two things. I mean, one is the fact that, you know, the entire United States foreign and security structure was shaped. Of course, it was shaped by the Second World War, but above all, it was shaped, you know, by the decades of the Cold War. You know, remember that in 1940 or 1939, the United States had an army about the size of Portugal's. You know, there was no CIA. The State Department was vastly smaller. All of these things grew up during the Cold War and therefore fundamentally shaped by the Cold War. But I think the other thing is that was remarked in the wake of Vietnam by a number of people. William McNeill wrote about this, that, you know, Vietnam should have been a deeply chastening experience for the United States. It should have led the United States to examine some of its fundamental myths. I always remember in Apocalypse Now, Captain Willard says, "I wanted a mission, and for my sins they gave me one. And when it was over, I'd never want another," which is obviously Francis Ford Coppola saying, you know, this is where thinking of your great missions gets you. But of course, as has often been remarked, President Reagan was elected essentially to put these American myths, these American gods, back on their pedestal again. And that led, in my view, directly to the disaster of Iraq, where America went in on the basis of the same unconsidered myths about itself and what it could do in the world. Well, the frightful thing about Clinton's memoirs, but it has to be said, you know, once again, so much of the establishment in general, is that once again, just as the lessons of Iraq, of Vietnam weren't learned, the lessons of Iraq are not being learned. Because in many ways they conflict so deeply with the myths of American civic nationalism that they cannot be learned by people who are, you know, who are nationalists to the core. And I've just been reading a couple of books about the U.S. campaign in southern Afghanistan from 2001 to 2004 or so, which were the critical years when there was a possibility of winning over the local population and winning over, you know, many of the local commanders who had and chieftains who had supported the Taliban. Instead, it wasn't just that the U.S. allowed the U.S. forces on the ground allowed themselves to be manipulated by local warlords into killing or arresting these people who, in most cases, actually wanted to surrender. They wanted to come over. But their local rivals, allied with the U.S., basically misinformed the U.S. Into doing their dirty work for them. But what is truly frightful in these books is that it seems that the U.S. forces who arrested these people then tortured them automatically. Not systematically, because there was no system involved in the questioning or whatever, but just as a matter of course would torture them. In other words, Abu Ghraib was in no sense an anomaly. It was the rule in both Afghanistan and Iraq at the time for just about everybody who was arrested. Well, I mean, not merely did this essentially lose the war in southern Afghanistan, but, you know, it is in fact quite disgraceful. And yet the facts of this have been overwhelmingly obscured in the American media and in the American public debate. I think, once again, b- because it is just too painful to recognize. But as a result, there's been grossly inadequate, serious analysis of what actually went wrong in Afghanistan. Incidentally, I should say that I blame my own country, Britain, much, much more for this, because, of course, Britain had a history in that part of the world which should have taught us some much better. But Britain has become just as incapable of learning from the past as the United States. I mean, all we take from the past is this, pathetic notion of ourselves as a great power, learning something about how actually to exercise, or preferably not to exercise, power, that seems now beyond us.
You describe in the piece in The Nation the United States and Clinton very prominently in the grip of a nationalist solipsism, which is a nice phrase. Is there a way out of this? The example of Britain is not inspiring in that regard, as Britain seems to be constantly trying to relive past glories. The United States not quite as along the road of decline as Britain, not capable of the least bit of reflection. I mean, is there a way out?
Well, I mean, like I suppose many people, I had high hopes of Obama in that regard. I mean, it has to be said, I mean, he's disappointed us. I mean, not totally in domestic policy. I read what Paul Krugman had to say on that score with some approval, that within the constraints of the enormous constraints of the American Constitution and the present political system, Obama has not done as well as he could, but he hasn't done nearly as badly as he could either in domestic politics. In foreign policy, I think what we have seen is the degree to which a U.S. president is in fact trapped by the existing system, by the existing lobbies, especially, of course, Israel, but on other issues as well, by the absolute bipartisan commitment to American global hegemony, or leadership, as it's called in Washington. Now, that said, I think that, put it this way, an American president of the past, Obama has been described as an Eisenhower Republican, and I think that's true to a great extent in his deeper instincts. But I think that Ike, faced with the present position, would have had, of course, Ike, was after all the victor of the Second World War. He had just so much more prestige and power within the system. But I think Ike would also have had the moral courage to come out and say, look, given all the disasters we have suffered in recent years, given our domestic economic situation, given our fiscal situation, given our indebtedness to China and, the growth of the Chinese economy compared to ours, the time has really come for hard choices. Clinton's book is called Hard Choices. In fact, she doesn't make a single hard choice in the entire book. It's a systematic attempt to avoid hard choices by still saying that, America can have everything. I think that Ike would have made some hard choices and, would essentially have backed away from certain American commitments and would, in other areas, have sought essentially the best compromise that, can be got over Iran's nuclear program, for example, and over the status of Ukraine. That is, of course, partly because Ike was working in, at a time when the U.S. political system itself had, it seems, many more capabilities than it does now. But it is also because Ike, with all his faults, which were not small in certain areas, but still with all his faults, Ike was a statesman. It does seem very difficult these days for Western democracies to produce statesmen of that kind. I mean, if one's looking for an even more shattering contrast, look at France. While Ike was still president of the United States, de Gaulle became president of France. Look at the more recent set of presidents of France.
The entire EU landscape is pretty grim at the moment.
Well, yes.
Rather sobering that we should long for a new Eisenhower. This age and age of diminished expectations.
Well, yes, but you know, I mean, I took some very bad actions in foreign affairs, of course. But you know, I mean, I've just been reading about how Ike, in '53, you know, blocked Republican pressure for a rollback of the Soviet Union. He blocked the British, French, and Israeli attack on Suez. And you know, he coined, you know, he as his speeches reflect, I mean, he was deeply aware, A, of the dangerous power of the military-industrial complex. Fascinating that so many American students today think that it was somebody like Lenin who coined the phrase military-industrial complex, not a Republican president. But Ike, you know, if you read his speeches, was also deeply aware that national strength in the end came from economic strength, and not just economic strength, but also social solidarity. You know, that the American economy had to provide goods for the American people as a whole. That is something which the Republican Party in particular has, of course, totally forgotten. And I think on that as well, I mean, of course, Obama has not been nearly as radical in domestic politics as many of us would have wished. But in that sense, he is, you know, he is at least an Eisenhower Republican, which, you know, in present circumstances is not the worst thing to be by a very long shot.
That was Anatole Levin, who teaches at Georgetown University campus in Qatar. You can find his article on Hillary on the Nation's website, thenation.com. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News.
Well, I'm beginning to see the light. Well, I'm beginning to see the light. Some people work very hard, but still they never do it right. Well, I'm beginning to see the light. Well, I'm beginning to see the light.
That was some of the Velvet Underground's Beginning to See the Light in a live performance from 1969 on a newly released 6-CD deluxe set with lots of great stuff on it. Next, Alex Vitelli. Alex teaches sociology at Brooklyn College and specializes in cops. With cops much in the news, Alex's perspective is essential. Alex Vitelli. Ferguson, of course, on everybody's mind right now. You specialize in the New York Police Department, right? Well, how is a little town's police force different from a big city police force? The way it's run and the people who populate it, and it's the way it polices.
Well, one of the really insidious things we've learned about Ferguson, and it has to do with the reshaping of the suburban landscape, is that St. Louis County is made up of all these small municipalities that were really created to sort of facilitate white flight. And now they have a tax base problem. As the state's role has shrunk, these municipalities are competing for a little bit of commercial activity, trying to keep property taxes down. So they're financing themselves on speeding tickets and parking tickets and various fees. And a lot of what was driving, interestingly, the resentment in Ferguson was the incredible burden of these tickets, which people couldn't always pay, that then become warrants, and then people are getting arrested on the warrants. And over 50% of Ferguson's municipal revenues were coming from these ticketing policies. So you got the police basically acting as revenue collectors, an almost all white force and a mostly black community out there punitively fining people all the time. And by tying it to revenue in this way, it becomes very kind of analogous to the quota system that we've had here in New York, where officer discretion really goes out the window and the officer is just there to generate as much paper and by extension as much revenue as they can. And I think that really poisons the relationship as well, because you just can't talk to the officer. They're not interested in your story. They're not interested in your circumstance. They're not interested in like what's the most just or best outcome of this interaction. It's just an opportunity to write another ticket.
Now, look at a guy like Darren Wilson. He seems like not the kind of guy with the most congenial politics or worldview that one could hope for. How typical is he of it, that kind of police force? And how much does that matter? I mean, how much of it is structural? How much of it comes down from the top? How much of it is the situation he's put in? And how much of it is the personality of the cop?
Well, it's a mix. You know, policing has always been a kind of reservoir for conservative white politics, for a certain amount of racism. The John Birchers and KKK have always had a hold in that world that exceeds their hold in a lot of other realms. So I think it's not irrelevant, especially in some of these smaller municipalities where diversity is really lacking. But the bigger problem of over-policing of communities of color is really a policy problem. It's tied to a much larger and much more insidious politics of race at all levels of government, the kind of not so thinly veiled code words about crime being really a stand-in for race, and the kind of mobilization of criminal justice resources to, you know, enforce existing racial and social arrangements.
Some people are talking about diversifying police forces. How much of a difference would that make, or has that made?
Very little. You know, it might make a little difference in terms of some of the worst individual abuses by officers, but it would do nothing to stop the general problem of over-policing, mass incarceration, et cetera. And I think it's a real mistake to invest too heavily in that strategy. We have some pretty concrete examples that show the fallacy of this. You take a city like Philadelphia that has a residency requirement for officers, and the demographics of the police force are pretty much in line with the demographics of the city. The terrible problems with corruption, excessive use of force, you know, mistreatment of people, discourteousness. It's not a solution to these problems.
Well, it seems in some ways like the military. You put people into an impossible situation and they're going to evolve into monsters even if they weren't to start with.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it. If not necessarily monsters, at least we're putting them in an impossible situation. And this leads to another, I think, failed reform strategy, which is to try to talk about some kind of community policing or training police to be more courteous. And this is a really misguided strategy that fundamentally misunderstands the police role. The police are there to put hands on people. They are there to use, they're the coercive force of the state.
Was it Mayor Daley said to preserve disorder?
Yes, and so once you go down that road, they cannot structurally be officer friendly, especially if they're waging a war on drugs, especially if they're pursuing a kind of broken windows policing strategy, especially if they're engaged in these kinds of mass stop and frisk activities, because those tactics cannot but upset the community. And so that's going to create a dynamic of escalating tensions. And when officers are faced with what is now, you know, kind of widespread everyday resistance to their policing, the refusals to cooperate, the kind of stuff we saw Eric Garner do tragically on video, they feel they cannot be nice. They cannot be courteous because they feel like they're trying to keep a lid on an impossible situation. And the solution is not to make them nicer, it's to change their role in the equation.
What is different about the U.S.? You see these comparative statistics. The FBI says 400 police homicides a year. Those are a severe undercount by most readings. In Europe, fewer than 10 in many countries. What is different about the United
Sometimes
States?
Sometimes fewer than 10 for the whole continent.
What's different?
Well, there's a few things here. One is that we got guns everywhere. And a certain percentage of these police shootings are real gunfights, where both parties have guns. And so, you know, it's hard to, you know, make a big case about those kinds of interactions as such. But the other thing is just the level of racialized inequality that we have in the U.S. and the extent to which we have turned social problems, community problems into police problems, and the extent to which the solution to those problems are punitive in nature. And so this is creating this kind of poison dynamic where the police have come to believe that they are, you know, not just a thin blue line between crime and safety, but the enforcers of a kind of moral order, and that they believe they're the only thing that is keeping society from coming unglued, in part because we have this incredibly racially polarized society.
And what about our habit of criminalizing so many things? Other countries don't criminalize as much as we do, do they?
Of course, and that has to do, again, with a kind of moralizing, but also that is the politics of race in the U.S. You know, that was a big part of the Republican Southern strategy of the 60s and 70s, which was we can't go back and reopen the issue of segregation, but we can try to find a new way to frame race relations without calling it that. And a lot of this is well explained by Michelle Alexander in her book, The New Jim Crow, that basically we can use crime as a code word for race, and we can use getting tough on crime as a code word for getting tough on non-white people. And that is a way of saying that whatever social problems exist, whatever racial inequalities exist, they should be understood as a product of the moral failings of the suspect group. And since it's a moral failing, not a structural problem with, you know, the deindustrialization or whatever, that the appropriate solution is one of a kind of moral reminder meted out through police violence and arrest and harassment.
Of course, the white incarceration rate is still considerably higher than anywhere else in the world as well. So the racial angle creates a horrendous black incarceration rate, but even the white incarceration rate is off the charts compared to other countries.
Well, this is the thing about our changing systems of racial control, right? You know, Jim Crow was not slavery. It created opportunities for people. There were ways to get around it for some people. It was not slavery. Mass incarceration is not Jim Crow. It has created space for elites like Obama and Oprah to rise to their levels. And in its desire to appear race neutral, it also has scooped up large numbers of white people. But it's still primarily a tool of, I think, managing race both as a political trope and as an actual population.
And the numbers of police shootings, they seem to have achieved a prominence in the news and in our imaginations, really accelerated in the last couple of years. Are the numbers up, or are we just perceiving them differently?
I think we're perceiving them differently. The numbers are not up dramatically, and in fact, if we go back to the 70s, in many parts of the country, the number of police shootings is down dramatically, including here in New York. There was a real tightening up of firearms policies and also some judicial decisions, Supreme Court rulings about, you know, you can't shoot fleeing suspects that came down in the 80s that tightened this stuff up. So shootings have not gone up dramatically. And in many ways, you know, what happened in Ferguson was completely non-exceptional. The only thing that was exceptional about it was that people went out into the streets over it. That was what was exceptional, because these shootings are happening literally on a daily basis, but usually there's no real community uproar about it. And it's been that community uproar that I think has fueled a kind of national groundswell.
I'm speaking with Alex Vitale, who teaches sociology at Brooklyn College.
Yeah, what's happened? In the last few weeks, there's been an amazing upsurge of demonstrations across the country. Right after the grand jury decision came down, I think CNN counted demonstrations in 170 cities. We're at
I'm sure that's an undercount.
Near where we sit in Brooklyn. They're all over New York City. What happened? Why are people suddenly rebelling against this order?
Well, I think the origins of this might be best traced back to the Trayvon Martin case. I think that's where I at least saw the first signs of a kind of change in the tone of reaction, where there was a kind of convergence of some of the well-established civil rights-oriented organizations, racial justice groups, and a kind of media attention and a kind of grassroots responsiveness. So we also had large protests around the country around Trayvon Martin, and I think some of those same forces were built upon in responding to Ferguson. But the reality is that, you know, there is a grassroots response to these calls, and that's not always the case. There's always organizations, individuals who are willing to put out calls, but then no one shows up most of the time, or very few people. And what's happening now is both that people are showing up and spontaneous organizing is happening. So even my students at Brooklyn College have had walkouts, lunchtime rallies, have gone to Manhattan for some of these demonstrations. And this is pretty unusual at a, you know, working class commuter school.
Yeah, I found the demo in the neighborhood on Twitter. Are social media making a difference?
Social media is a facilitator. It's not a creator. There was an article in the New York Post this week that was basically written by dissident elements in the police department complaining that they were outmaneuvered by tech-savvy protesters. And I think that's mostly ridiculous, that basically people have smartphones and are watching the Twitter feeds and maybe live streaming, and that is allowing some people to join up once something started. It's allowing people to maybe coordinate different marches a little bit, but it's not creating the movement on the ground. Is it helping to spark popular interest because of the social media stuff? It's possible that that has raised the sense of crisis, but keep in mind it's happening at the same time as widespread mainstream media coverage. So it's not like people can only find out what's going on through social media.
Yeah, I can't say that I've been actually watching the TV, so I haven't been following how it's been covered. What's the media been saying?
Well, you know, we have a dispersed, decentralized media now, and it has been interesting to kind of watch the tension between, you know, CNN and MSNBC and what's going on in local stations and, of course, Fox. So, you know, people are tending to choose a media outlet that comports with their existing worldview. And so there's a kind of diversity of ways of thinking about this and talking about it. I think, but all of them have been covering it. And that raises the legitimacy of the issue as an issue, even if they may be framing it in a reactionary or liberal way.
Well, there's an old saying in the public opinion business, we can't tell you what to think, but we can tell you what to think about.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely happening. And then I think the same thing happens with social media, right? It's people are friends with people who think the way they do. They're following people on Twitter who think the way they do. So it does have a kind of accelerator effect of sort of doubling down on what you already are inclined to think. And that may be raising people's ire and expectations that could be a motivating force.
And back to policy. Obama on Monday said a few things that were rather mild. He wants better training, more of a discussion, lamented the fact that there's tensions between the cops and communities of color, but really wasn't seeming to change much of anything, and appointed the former head of the D.C. police to run a commission. What do you make of his policy package?
Well, it's par for the course, right? I mean, remember the Henry Louis Gates incident, where the major outcome of that was to take the officer out for beers at the White House. That did not exactly send a strong signal about, you know, accountability, about moving forward on race relations, about taking seriously over policing, et cetera. And my expectations for this commission are pretty low. The cop they put in charge, who was in D.C. and is now in Philadelphia, he's a progressive police executive. He's African-American. We've spoken before. He has some good ideas, but the fundamental orientation will be to preserve the police role as a sort of the central agency for managing crime and disorder problems. He's not going to put himself out of a job by coming out with recommendations that say, well, we should decriminalize drugs. We should dramatically move away from broken windows-oriented enforcement. We should civilianize, you know, our response to all kinds of social problems. That's just not even in the cards.
So I was about to ask you what the Vitale Commission would recommend.
Yeah, so the Vitale Commission would recommend a dramatic rethink of the police role. I think that we need to get the police out of the business of dealing with drugs, out of the business of school safety, out of the business of dealing with the homeless folks, mentally ill folks, people in the sex industry. Their role is primarily counterproductive in these areas. And even in areas like juvenile youth gangs, juvenile street violence, there are real community-based alternatives out there that should be invested in. A little of that is happening in New York, but we should be looking at the cure violence stuff that's going on in a bunch of cities, in street mediation programs, in violence interrupters, bringing in the older generation that's been on the streets and learned some lessons and having them work with the kids. And finally, you know, we've got to come up with some avenues out of, you know, this deeply entrenched, isolated poverty that affects so many young people of color. And that is nowhere on the president's agenda or much of anyone else's agenda in power. We have no urban policy. We have no plan for addressing poverty. The best you can hope for is people talking about the middle class, but we have a growing poverty problem, a growing underclass, record levels of mass homelessness, and that's not on the political agenda at all.
Well, we also had, you know, a remarkable decline in the crime rate over the last 20 years, yet there seems to be no let up in the police pressure. Why are we still pushing so hard on the cops?
Well, I think the cops really believe in two fallacies. One is that they are responsible for the crime drop. And two, that the only thing making cities livable is aggressive over-policing of poor non-white people. And they and the politicians who support them are scared to death that any uptick in crime or disorder will be blamed on them, and that it will be politically damaging, and that it's more important to just keep a lid on this stuff, and the way to do that is massive over-policing.
What can local governments do? And we have some pretty good people on this. Before we hit the record button, we were talking about people on the city council. Can city council people do make a difference in cities? Can mayors make a difference, or is it?
They can. They certainly can. I mean, they're not totally handcuffed by very real financial constraints. Just this week, de Blasio here in New York announced $130 million to reframe the way we think about folks in mental health crisis. Right now, our primary response is that the police come and take people into the criminal justice system. Rikers Island, 30, 40, 50% of the people in there have a significant mental health diagnosis. It's incredibly expensive and counterproductive to put them through the criminal justice system. So the mayor's team has announced they're going to try to divert as many people as possible with mental health issues from the criminal justice system. Now, it still means that if you need mental health treatment, the only avenue for getting it is through the police. There has to be that initial police interaction that then brings you to a mental health court or gets you into jail where they can get you into a treatment facility. So it's still housed within the criminal justice apparatus.
And will there always be the threat of jail if you don't behave in the mental?
And generally that's the case, yes, that's always the backstop. And a lot of these treatment programs are really just running people around in circles and don't have real exit points for like long-term stability. You know, what we need is permanent housing with supportive services, which ironically, is a lot cheaper than putting people at Rikers Island or in state prison.
We have people proposing things like stronger civilian review boards, body cameras, better screening of police. But then what you were talking about earlier was a much broader agenda of decriminalization and, you know, just removal of the law enforcement from large spheres of life. What do you think of that smaller bore agenda? Could it make a difference?
Not really. It could make a difference at the margins, but it's not going to address. For instance, we've seen primarily these very high profile cases, often resulting in death. And sometimes those encounters involve police misconduct or training problems. But there are hundreds of thousands of arrests just here in New York, millions across the country, that are completely legal, follow proper police procedure, and are incredibly destructive. And dealing with that can't be accomplished through retraining or body cameras, because that assumes that there's some kind of misconduct or improper procedure, when in fact the mass criminalization of communities of color is the policy and is being properly pursued by the officers tasked with pursuing it. And so how do you hold them accountable for following the policy they've been told to follow?
That's Alex Vitale, who teaches sociology at Brooklyn College. His 2008 book, City of Disorder, is a study of quality of life policing in New York. I asked Alex for a comment on the New York grand jury's failure to indict an NYPD cop for the chokehold death of Eric Garner. His comment: people should not be relying on the criminal justice system to fix the problems in policing. It's going to take committed social movement challenges to the criminal justice system. This story will play out in the streets and not in the courtroom. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more from that new Velvet Underground 6-CD set, This I Can't Stand It. Till next week, bye.
I keep sitting around, living in a garbage pail. My old lady called me up, she's trying to hit me with a mop. I can't stand it anymore, more. I can't stand it anymore, more. I can't stand it anymore, more. But if Shelly would just come back, it'd be alright. If Shelly would just come back, it'd be alright. I live with 13 dead cats, a purple dog that whisks fast.